This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, lots of mostly Black school districts are returning to local control after years of state takeovers. But a recent article shows that these public schools are still starved for money. We'll hear from Howie Hawkins, who wants to run for president on the Green Party ticket. A MOVE member is finally freed from a Pennsylvania prison. And a former Black Panther who spent 48 years in prison is hoping to be paroled in September.
But first, hundreds of left activists and scholars gathered in Brooklyn, New York, this past weekend for the Left Forum, the biggest annual gathering of leftist activists and scholars in the nation. Black Agenda Report senior columnist Margaret Kimberly was on hand. We asked Kimberly to make sense of the never-ending warfare between the corporate media and President Trump. Trump threatened to attack Iran after that nation shot down a spy drone and then called off the attack. The corporate media was not pleased, since they only praise Trump when he attacks other countries.
The corporate media, New York Times and Washington Post, questioned his decision, said it looked indecisive, it was potentially dangerous, and for all of their alleged opposition to him, we can see that they are still very much on board with the imperial project and with the belief that the United States has the right to intervene anywhere in the world at any time. It was very dangerous because Trump's team, Bolton and Pompeo, the National Security Advisor and the Secretary of State, very definitely want an attack on Iran. It had been building for some time. There were these mysterious explosions on oil tankers. No one believes that Iran was behind this. Why would Iran at this moment, when the Trump administration is most bellicose, why would they do something like that, which could trigger an attack on their country, in addition to the attacks on their economy and on their people through sanctions? And the Prime Minister of Japan, Prime Minister Abe, was just in Iran meeting with President Rouhani. Japan wants to keep buying Iranian oil, so it is absurd to think that Iran was behind those incidents.
Now, the corporate media attacks Trump for not attacking militarily countries, but they also attack him for worsening relations with America's allies. But most of America's allies, except for Israel, don't want the United States attacking Iran.
No, they don't, but they don't really take a stand. Trump pulled out of the so-called Iran nuclear deal more than a year ago. Iran did nothing. The Europeans were promising to help them through a new monetary system so they could still trade and not be subject to U.S. sanctions. More than a year later, they had not made good on any of their promises, and at that point, Iran said it might continue enriching uranium. So the Europeans are stuck in between. They don't really have the strength or the will to stand up to the United States. And so they end up capitulating to Trump. So we can't expect anything more of them, but they vacillate. Sometimes they go right along with Trump. For example, in Venezuela, when the U.S. announced that they had chosen this president, the European nations went right along with it. So sometimes they oppose, sort of, kind of, and then other times they just go right along.
Well, then Trump really isn't misestimating the Europeans, since they sometimes go along but never really fight back.
Correct. I can't remember the last time they actually put their feet down and told America, no, we're not going to go along with, or that they're going to oppose. The European countries, I think they have the ability to say no to sanctions and say, well, you can sanction Iran, but we're not going to. And if you're going to sanction the rest of us, let's see what you've got. I think the U.S. would back down, but they don't think that or don't care enough to really take that action.
Now, Trump says that his goal is to get Iran's oil exports down to zero. But that would mean that China, its main customer, not buy anything from Iran.
Right. China and India, other countries are Iran's customers. So it really doesn't make any sense. These attempts will fail. Any military attack will increase the price of oil. So the U.S. has painted itself into a rhetorical corner, or maybe truly a corner, by going along with Israel and Saudi Arabia, who are Iran's enemies. But they cannot, there's not going to be any regime change without a war, a shooting war that would kill millions of people, and the United States isn't willing to do that, and no one is backing them up. Plus, there are countries that might help Iran. So we'll see how far they're really willing to go and who's going to blink first.
Democrats in the House are making even louder noises these days about moving forward to impeach Trump, although they recognize that the Senate would never convict. But Nancy Pelosi still seems to be coy about this.
Well, she doesn't want to do it. She's being pushed, though. And the people are pushing, you know, having talked about Trump endlessly, having made Trump the person to run against, not any policy per se, but just against Trump. They get the House majority, and people across the country expect the Democrats to impeach him. I don't believe there's evidence, it's pretty clear in the Russiagate investigation after Mueller is finished, there are no impeachable offenses for him there, but there are other possible impeachable offenses against him. So her people are pushing her, but she does not want to do it. Politically, I don't see how it hurts the Democrats. Republican-controlled House impeached Bill Clinton, but the Senate did not vote to remove. But they wanted to throw enough dirt to hurt Gore's chances, and that did, among other things, help Bush steal enough votes to squeak through.
Well, yes, most folks say that there's a treasure trove of possibly impeachable offenses in Trump's behavior. But the Democrats still want to do Russiagate.
Well, Russiagate is so valuable to them. Russiagate is their excuse for losing. They don't have to explain how Hillary Clinton raised $1 billion and then couldn't get 80,000 more votes to win the electoral vote in addition to the popular vote. Russiagate also keeps them from acceding to the demands of the people. People want a higher minimum wage. They want free college, Medicare for all. And Russiagate's also, I think it works because it's comforting to people. It explains away the unexplainable. It seemed to be impossible that Trump would win. And so people cling to it. So it's there's a little mutual, speaking of collusion, I think, between Democratic voters and their party about continuing to ramp up the Russiagate story. And the final report, you know, Mueller wanted to have it both ways. I think he did something wrong, but I can't say, but you can't indict him. And there's enough wiggle room there for people to still think that there was Russian government involvement in the 2016 campaign. And it works for the Democrats, not in the way it ought to work for them. It's something that lets them off the hook and also helps them because they are anti-Russian in their foreign policy. So they get to have a reason to take part in these adventures around the world, the interventions, the sanctions, and so forth against other countries.
Lots of Democrats were anxiously awaiting Bernie Sanders' 2020 campaign after his amazing 2016 campaign. But it seems that the party has answered his second call by assembling a mob of competitors.
Yes, if there are enough people, it will be hard for him to get enough delegates at the convention to win on the first round. And in the second round, they will let the superdelegates, the elected officials, and this is, by the way, the most undemocratic setup of all, that there are people across the country that can undo the will of Democratic voters. But if he goes to the convention in the lead, it will be difficult for him to have enough delegates, and they can't steal the nomination from him by following their rules.
Bernie Sanders' proposals are supermajority proposals. That is, they're backed by overwhelming numbers of Democrats. And that scared lots of corporate folks in the Democratic Party. But now it seems that everybody's for Medicare for all and Me Too's all around in terms of the other candidates.
Sure. They saw the handwriting on the wall. They saw how the public responded. These are things that people need and want. And they know that's what people want to hear. They have no intention of actually doing it. One of Nancy Pelosi's staff members was caught on tape apparently telling lobbyists, oh, don't worry about Medicare for All. We're not really going to do that. So these are just words meant to get out the vote, to keep as much support from Democratic voters as possible. But they have no intention of allowing any of these proposals to see the light of day. And even if by some miracle Bernie Sanders were able to become president, he would spend a lot of his time fighting his own party and not just the Republicans.
But isn't that the good fight? What's wrong with fighting for what people want?
That is what you're supposed to do. But ideally, we would have a president and a Congress who give us what we want. But we have these entrenched people, the Nancy Pelosi's of the world, who, you know, what does she do? She just raises money. And she says this herself whenever she's criticized for anything. Well, I'm worth it. I raise so much money. And basically, she's a wealthy person herself. She picks up the phone. She gets her friends to give money to the Democratic Party. And they give expecting to see what they want, which is no change at all. More austerity, no damage done to the health insurance industry, which has created all of our health care problems. But that is what we're stuck with. We're stuck with the party that is looking for ways to keep from giving their voters what their voters want.
So basically, Democratic voters are expected to vote for the opponent to Trump, whoever that is, strictly on the basis of Trump's horrific racism.
Yeah, that's it. And they're pretty honest about it. It's like anybody but Trump, any blue will do. We've been browbeaten ever since November 2016. Most important thing is to get rid of Trump. Anybody who didn't vote for Hillary Clinton is blamed for Trump being in the White House. So this has been their MO all along. And, you know, Trump does not make this any easier. He, of course, makes the case against himself every time he opens his mouth or post some crazy tweet, and his base, they like him because of his open racism, so he is an easy target. But of course, we know that Democrats could give people what they want and get rid of Trump, but he has become a foil that they look forward to. They use him to raise money, they use him to get out the vote, but without doing what people want them to do.
Lots of folks in the leftish circles of the Democratic Party wanted Bernie Sanders to speak out more on foreign policy, and he does seem to be taking more positions than before.
Yeah, it's still not. It's his progressive credentials are basically with domestic policy. I will not forget in 2016 he called Hugo Chavez a dead communist dictator. On Venezuela, he just says, and Iran, Trump should have to come to Congress before he took any military action. Instead of saying, what would he vote to do if Trump were to come to Congress? He should be saying, I would vote no. I would vote against these military attacks. He should start speaking out about sanctions that kill so many people in Venezuela and in Iran. He has taken a lead on the issue of Yemen and ending U.S. Assistance to Saudi Arabia in Yemen, and that is commendable, but it doesn't go nearly far enough.
In 21st century America, it's considered leftish and maybe even radical just to insist that the Congress declares war and not the president. But no attention is paid whatsoever to international law, to the sovereignty of nations, to the United Nations Charter, or any of these documents.
Yeah, it's might makes right, and America can do whatever it wants. America's the exceptional nation. Only America has sovereignty. People are still, at this late date in history, talking about the Monroe Doctrine, and the U.S. can do anything it wants in this hemisphere, except they believe the U.S. can do anything it wants anywhere in the world and can tell Iran who they can or can't sell oil to, or starve their people with sanctions, or just deprive them of medicine. International law does not apply to the United States. And it's unfortunately a universally held belief, even by people who are leftish. They make the arguments against these foreign policy actions without raising the issue of human rights, the violations of human rights, the fact that people all over the world are entitled to certain rights based on international law. But if they acknowledge that, that would mean the United States would have to stop being the bully of the world. And there seems to be agreement amongst most Americans that the United States alone should have the right to do anything it wants, anywhere, to anyone.
The United States is always talking about leadership, and pundits keep on saying that Americans want their country to be the leader in the world, but the world speaks the language of international law. That's a civilizational institution that has evolved over centuries, and then America just ignores it.
Yes, and that's why these supposedly liberal newspapers did not condemn the fact that the Trump administration ever considered taking any action against Iran. That's why they don't come out and say that it is wrong. They are equally imperialist. It's a matter of degree. It's a matter of the kind of language used. But ultimately, they are on the side of presidents, and whether Democrat or Republican, tend to take the same sorts of actions all over the world.
The Syrian government and its allies have begun an offensive in Idlib province. That's the enclave where an estimated 50,000 jihadists, al-Qaeda and their allies, are holed up. The Syrian government says they can't tolerate that jihadist enclave existing anymore. So another crisis is coming because the U.S. corporate media treats these al-Qaeda jihadists as simply rebels fighting what the Americans call a dictatorial regime.
Yes, but these jihadists were sent by the U.S., by Saudi Arabia and the other Persian Gulf monarchy states, with support from NATO and the EU, to take out the Syrian government. They hope to achieve in Syria what they did in Libya, which also happened with the help of jihadists who are America's proxies. They know it's not realistic to send troops, so they use proxies. Russians, with their air power, helped the Syrian army clear many of them out of their country, but they remain in this Idlib province. It would be obviously good for Syria to get rid of the last of these people tearing their country apart, but it would be good for the United States to learn that it cannot get away with everything that it wants to do. And it's a good thing that Syria has friends in the world who will assist them.
That was Black Agenda Report. Senior columnist Margaret Kimberly speaking from the Left Forum in New York City.
Jeff Bryant is a journalist who's been following the plight of urban school systems for many years. Bryant is senior correspondent for Our Schools, a project of the Independent Media Institute. His latest article is titled, Why Many Urban School Districts Are Being Set Up for Fiscal Failure. He says that as schools became more black and brown, state governments seized control from local school boards and put appointed consultants in charge. Now, many of these school districts are returning to local control. But Bryant says the damage has already been done.
I think in nearly every case, what we're seeing about these schools that are returning to local democratic control is that many of the problems that led to the collapse of the districts and their takeover to begin with have not been addressed the whole time that the takeover took place. Some of those problems include, yes, lack of funding. That's probably the main reason that many of these school districts got into trouble to begin with, is because in the states where they're located, the schools have very inequitable funding. The school districts that need the most amount of money because of poverty issues, because of the density of special needs students, many of these school districts actually get the least amount of money from the state that they're located in. That's one of the reasons why the schools got into trouble. But during the takeover, the state agencies or managers that took over those schools didn't deal with that. So, in other words, the takeover never treated the real problems that caused the school's troubles to begin with.
That in many of these cities, now that they are returning to local elected school board supervision, they actually are quite different school systems. In New Orleans, almost all the schools are charters, and soon every single one of them will be. In Newark, I believe about 40% of the schools are charters, and similarly in Detroit. So these elected school boards have very shrunken domains to oversee.
Yes, that's the other issue that the state takeovers almost uniformly all share, is that this prescription that these takeover agencies followed, part of it was to privatize the schools, which is what charter schools are. They're privately operated schools that get public funding. And in a privately operated school, there are legal issues that they don't have to deal with. That's the flexibility, they call it, that charters get, is they are immune from certain requirements that public schools have to follow. And that includes the accountability to the state and to the elected board. That means that the charters are free to do things that other schools, publicly operated schools, have to comply with. So state has returned the school district to local control. But because of the presence of charters, many of the schools are not really technically under the control of the elected board anymore.
But that doesn't mean that the charter forces don't have great influence with the school board itself. Teach for America, for example, doesn't just provide teachers, but its alumni have been encouraged to get deep into the politics of cities, which they do, and they're backed by many of the very rich people who also support charter schools. So we have charter school members getting elected to local school boards in St. Louis, in Newark, other places.
Yes. Also, there's an incredible amount of money that's coming from outside of these districts to influence the local elections. You see that in nearly every case. School boards contests at one time were these sleepy affairs where candidates could get elected with as little as less than $1,000. You know, they could run their campaigns with just a few hundred dollars and mostly just go door to door. That's changed now because of these national groups such as Teach for America, Democrats for Education Reform, Stand with Children. Many of these groups now are very heavily influencing local board elections. So now candidates that align with these groups, which all support charter schools, they spend many, many thousands of dollars often to get elected. And so the school is being returned to local control, but now there are all these national influencers of the board elections. So again, a lot of these things have been baked into the cake of these districts during the takeover process. So it ties the hands of the locally elected board when they finally get control back.
And having baked it into the cake, maybe that's why the powers that be acceded to a return to local control, because those larger forces already had been institutionalized in those systems.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing this influencing not just school boards and education and local school districts. We're seeing this influence in many other issues, too, of national importance. The issue of voting rights, for instance, that the Supreme Court just passed gerrymandering, saying that these heavily gerrymandered districts are constitutional. So, yeah, you can have the right to vote, but at the same time, you are going to be stuck in a municipality or a state where the districts are so heavily gerrymandered, your vote really doesn't count. So we're seeing this kind of anti-democratic influence infiltrating nearly every aspect of our political lives.
Yes, so we have a situation in many of these cities where local activists can run for the school board, but they are in competition with people who are in league with billionaires and folks like, the current education secretary, DeVos.
Yes, Betsy DeVos has, through her foundations and her nonprofit organizations, has been a big investor into school board, local school board races, and state legislative races influencing those races. You can see in Michigan in particular, where she's based, her influence in the state legislature has been incredibly powerful. Nearly every Republican lawmaker in that state has gotten money from her. Hence, Michigan has one of the highest percentages of students attending charter schools, and over 80% of the charter schools in Michigan are for-profit organizations that make money off of the children who live there. And in the meantime, Michigan, who used to be in the top 20, I believe, of measures on education attainment and achievement, now it's ranked way lower. I think it's in the bottom 10 or near the bottom 10. So her influence on elections and education in the state of Michigan has been horrible for children.
You've paid particular attention to the school system in St. Louis, a system that has shrunken to about one quarter of its former size in the past 50 years or so. Now that St. Louis system is under, for the first time in about 12, 13 years, under local control, but its funding is just barely above 2007 levels, and the scene, like in other cities, has changed. Charters are there, and all these outside influences have become entrenched.
Yeah, the other thing that we haven't touched on, which is definitely a situation in St. Louis, but also in New Orleans and some of these other cities, is how gentrification has transformed these cities. The demographic makeup, particularly of a place like New Orleans now, is completely different from what it was before Hurricane Katrina. St. Louis has also had tremendous flight of Black families leaving the city. And a lot of this happened by design. And a lot of this demographic change is heavily influenced by the real estate industry and local developers who throw most of their investment into building buildings that are, for instance, for young professionals and for corporate offices rather than for families. And a lot of the investment goes into white parts of the community and not the Black residential neighborhoods. And so consequently, a city like St. Louis that used to be 80-some percent Black by the year 2025, if trends hold, will be a majority white city. So that changes the makeup of the school population too. And this is intentional. And when the school population becomes more well-to-do and more white, the academic achievement changes over time. That almost happens universally. And it usually gets better. And the school systems can say, well, we're doing much better now. Look at our test scores. But the fact of the matter is, it's a different city with different children. And you must take into account that those demographic changes.
Yes, and these gentrifiers are entering St. Louis confident that they'll be sending their kids, if not to private schools, to charter schools populated by students that don't reflect the overwhelmingly Black composition of the public schools.
Right. And what happens usually, you see this in all these cities that we're talking about, is under the state takeover, the administrators will close schools in Black neighborhoods. That is almost always the case, creating these education deserts in Black communities. And what happens is people either put their kid on a bus or find other means of transportation to travel hours a day, or as we're seeing in St. Louis, the families move out. And when the families move out and abandon these neighborhoods, then what happens is the charter school will take over the abandoned building or some other structure in that community. And as soon as the charter school takes it over, the real estate values around the school are pumped up through speculation. The Black families can't buy the property there, so white families that are better off move in next door to the charter school. And so the charter school becomes this sort of beachhead, almost like an invasion, that is a forerunner to gentrifying the rest of the community.
Yes, many people don't realize that Ferguson, Missouri, which came to national prominence because of protests there back in 2015 and 14, is actually a push-out city on the edge of the Blackest neighborhoods of St. Louis, people that were pushed out by these very forces that you just described.
Yes, absolutely. It's a product of Black flight rather than white flight. And it's by design. The city of St. Louis used to be around the turn of the last century, the previous century, that a lot of neighborhoods were integrated in St. Louis because of the history of the city. It was an island in a Confederate sea. Technically, the state was a border state, but the rural population was heavily invested in the Confederate movement and slaveholding. St. Louis, which was settled primarily by Germans and other communities from Northern Europe, was not interested at all in separating from the U.S., did not believe in the Confederate cause. So when the Civil War ended, blacks, former slaves, came to St. Louis as kind of an island, as a place where they could start their businesses, have their families, not be subjected to prejudice. So many of the neighborhoods were integrated until different government entities, including the federal government, but also the state government, and then also industries such as the real estate industry, began designing this city based on where black people and white people ought to live. At least that's how they felt. And so it was a city that was segregated by design, and it can become a city that could be integrated by design, by redrawing school districts, for instance, through integration programs like what's been done in Louisville, Kentucky, and in Wake County, North Carolina. But during state control, none of that was addressed. The issue of race was not addressed sufficiently at all. And so now the local board is returning to a school district that is as segregated as it's ever been.
That was journalist Jeff Bryant of Our Schools and the Independent Media Institute.
Howie Hawkins is running for the Green Party's presidential nomination. Hawkins came up with a detailed plan for a massive Green New Deal nearly a decade ago. The Green Party adopted the Green New Deal as its own. But now Democrats like Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have put forward their own Green New Deal and put it before Congress. Hawkins says they watered down the deal and made it ineffective.
It was really a bad resolution. It removed what the Greens have been talking about since 2010. I happened to be the first candidate in the country to run on a Green New Deal. And then by the end of that year in 2010, I was running for governor of New York. 62 Greens signed on to a statement across the country. A number of them are at this conference. I think Kevin Zeese was running, David Schwartzman, Gloria Matera was my running mate. Coley Clark, I think, is here. She was running for U.S. Senate that year. So this has been our issue. And then they take it to get a national spotlight on it, but they dilute the content. We were calling for a ban on fracking and all new fossil fuel infrastructure. If we don't do that, it's over, because we'll build these gas-fired power plants and pipelines, and we'll be locked in for 3 or 4 decades of greenhouse gas emissions that'll make it game over. If that's not part of a Green New Deal, it's not serious. Secondly, they extended the deadline for getting to negative carbon emissions from 2030, which we were demanding, to 2050. You know, you give politicians another 20 years, what are they going to do? They're not going to do anything. You know, it's just a deadline. It's not realistic. And then we were saying demilitarization is key to a Green New Deal. That's where resources and also human capital, the engineers, we need to build this clean energy system and rework all our productive sectors. And they're building weapons, including these tactical nukes, which are insanity. So that was withdrawn. Even with that dilution, non-binding resolution, Pelosi won't bring it to the floor for a vote. McConnell said, oh, we'll bring it to a vote, because half the Senate, who are Democrats, are running for president. And they said, oh, it's a dirty trick. So they all voted present, although 4 of them voted against it. So the Democrats aren't even for a diluted, non-binding resolution for a Green New Deal. That's why the Green Party's got to have candidates. And not just me running for president if I get the nomination, but down ticket. And that's one reason. Now, to have a Green New Deal that means anything, it's got to be an eco-socialist Green New Deal. Exxon and the Koch brothers are not going to reinvest their fossil fuel earnings in renewables. Not going to happen. We got to take over the big oil and the power utility industry and probably some other sectors and do like we did during World War II, to turn industry on a dime into the arsenal of democracy to help defeat the fascists. The federal government took over and planned a quarter of the manufacturing sector. They either took it over from companies like GM or they built the factories themselves. We need to do nothing less to defeat climate change. The only difference is this time, instead of when it's over, we do it. We're not going to hand the factories to the super rich and the giant corporations like we did after World War II. We're going to let the workers run them as worker co-ops, if not public enterprises, so that we spread the wealth and have better distribution of income from the production we do. And that's another reason. We need, the socialist movement needs some socialists out here talking about what socialism is. Bernie Sanders saying, I'm a socialist. He's talking about New Deal liberalism. He just did a whole speech after saying in his speech in 2009, if anybody's, you hear anybody attacking me for being a socialist, I want you to know I don't believe in government ownership of the means of production. Well, social ownership, common ownership of the means of production is like the definition of socialism in the dictionary. And so Bernie's not doing that. So somebody needs to talk about what it is and why. Because Bernie's Economic Bill of Rights, which, you know, I've been campaigning as part of our Green New Deal, that's great, but it's not secure if you don't expropriate the billionaire class he's talking about. If they still have the power, that concentrated economic power translates into concentrated political power, and when they're not making concessions because we're mobilized, they're rolling things back. And that's what's happening now with, you know, the so-called welfare state or New Deal programs here and in Europe. And that's because the capitalists still have the power. So we got to have socialist economic democracy. Democracy needs socialism to have real political democracy. And so those are some of the arguments that we hope to put forward. And then the last one is that, and this is something that, you know, I really appreciated Bruce Dixon on, because he got it and we were trying to get, and I think we're making progress within the Greens and on the left, that we need a real party. We're the only country in the world where political parties aren't, you join based on, you agree with the principles and you pay some dues so the party has some money. Our parties, Democrat, Republican, and Green since the mid-90s, has been, really early 2000s, has been candidate organizations, which are like startup businesses. And then they go around begging for money from investors. And that's called the money primary. And then the ones that get the money get into the general primary and have a chance of winning, but the money is pre-selected who your choices are. So it's really a shifting coalition of, it's like a market. And then there are party committees, but you don't go there like you want to fight for a $15 minimum wage, you know, mobilize Queens to, you know, or Flushing, I'm looking at, you know, your community, and, you know, you don't go to the Democratic Global Party and say, how are we going to fight for 15? They don't do that. The committee is just to mobilize. And the fact that they're getting beat by AOC and this woman that just won the DA means even those committees are dissolving. There's no there there. So when people say we're going to take over the Democratic Party, what the hell are you going to take over? There's nothing to take over. You know, we need to build our own left party. And the thing about having a membership is then you can delegate to the state and national level based on living, breathing members. I mean, within the major parties and the Green Party, they sort of have virtual representation. The Greens have a spreadsheet that's 40 columns wide, and they have indicators of what you got going on in your state. How many candidates did you run? What votes did they get? What you're doing this year, that year? How many petition signatures you get? Etc. For 35 columns, and they got a bunch of math, and they weigh those things, and they come out with a number. Okay, so that allocates to a state, and then they represent these people that don't even know they're being represented because the structure is not organically connected to them. We got to stop that. And so that's one thing I'm going to try to raise within the Green Party and on the left. And the final thing is the left, we can't stand down because the left needs its own voice and identity. The organized left, the communists with the Popular Front in the 30s, and then the socialists with the Shachtman realignment strategy in the 70s, and then the new left, if they didn't go in with McGovern, they went in with Jackson into the Democratic Party. There's no left party or tendency that is independent of Democratic Party politics. And what happens to socialists like Bernie Sanders in the Democratic Party? He has to promise that he'll endorse Clinton in the end to even get into the, you know, on the ballot and into the debates. And that happens at every level. You know, if you're not a team player after the primaries, you're on the outs. We just had a session with Pramila Malik, who's a environmental activist, former union organizer, wanted to run in the Democratic Party against a Republican state senator who the Democrats never really challenged seriously. She got no support, and she got 43% of the vote. She wanted to run again, and they found a professional liberal tied to the nonprofit industrial complex, because this woman was fighting the Competitive Power Ventures Plan. That's the one Prococo got bribed for. You New Yorkers know who I'm talking about. Joe Prococo, the brother from another mother of Cuomo, who got bribed by the son of the guy who was in the torturers lobby, the law firm with Paul Manafort and Roger Stone and Lee Atwater and all those good people representing the Mobutus and the Savimbis and the Marcoses and the tobacco companies. And this guy is named Peter Kelly. He helped form the National Endowment for Democracy under Reagan, where the Democrats interfere in foreign elections and the Republicans, they each got their own operations. So his son did the bribe. Now they're both in jail. But the power structure of the Democratic Party didn't want to fight that because developers are making a lot of money on that. And Pramila was fighting them. And the power structure, and she named names, including Zephyr Teachout and all these professional liberals, they couldn't let Pramila run. So they found this woman, Jan Metzger, who's now the state senator. She's not fighting CPV, which is operating without an air permit, because some hack judge up in Albany said, oh, that's okay, you'll get the permit in 6 months. I mean, that's the kind of corruption in the two-party system that we got to fight. So anyway, we need an independent voice where people like Pramila, who are trying to get out of the Democrats and run as a Green next time, can speak, you know, and to the people. That's another thing. When you run as a Green, you're in there to the general election. You can speak to the people. Whereas if you run in the Democratic primary and they front you off like they did to Pramila, you're done. And then in the general election, your voice isn't even heard. So those are all reasons why we shouldn't stand down.
That was Green Party presidential hopeful Howie Hawkins speaking at the Left Forum in New York City.
Eddie Africa of the MOVE organization has been released from Pennsylvania's prison system. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, filed this report for Prison Radio.
The news came through like a beam in the night. Eddie Africa has been released today. Eddie Africa, MOVE member and survivor of the August 8, 1978 MOVE confrontation in Philadelphia, was free. Eddie Africa, after over 40 years in Pennsylvania state and U.S. federal prisons, was home. The news radiated like heat from a noonday summer sun, and men smiled as if seeing their grandchildren for the first time. 40 years is far more than 40 years if your name is Eddie Africa. That's because MOVE people faced the fury of county and state officials. And that meant a kind of cruelty that most prisoners have never seen nor imagined. He has survived beatings while handcuffed and at least one attempt to castrate him. He has been struck by weapons that have ruptured his abdominal wall. And lest we forget, he has been held in prison for over 40 years, despite evidence of his and other MOVE members' innocence of any crimes in connection with the MOVE confrontation of August 8, 1978. That said, Eddie Africa is beloved among prisoners for his positive spirit and his eccentric sense of humor. Now, Eddie Africa is with his loving family at home. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Jalil Abdul-Muntakim is a former Black Panther who has been in prison for the past 48 years for the killing of two police officers in 1971. Muntakim's co-defendant Herman Bell was released on parole last year, despite the loud opposition of the governor, New York City's mayor, and, of course, the police unions. Jalil Muntakim has had 10 parole hearings since he became eligible for release in 2002, but has been turned down each time. His next appearance before the parole board is in September. We spoke with a person that has stuck by Jalil Muntakim every day of nearly half a century of incarceration. His mother, 85-year-old Billy Bottoms Brown, who lives outside of Atlanta, Georgia.
It's been very depressing, been hard on the family in general. As I stated in one of my letters to the parole board, what they call the SORC, was that each time I visit, it takes a couple of weeks or so for me to get back to normal again. My leaving him there, for a long time, he didn't want me to visit. As a matter of fact, I've been trying to get there here recently, and he keeps saying no. He doesn't like for me to come because he feels that he's got me in prison as well. I haven't seen him now in 2 years. I was supposed to have gone in 16, but I had a horrific automobile accident, which prevented me from going. But his sister and brother went to visit at that particular time. And we don't get a chance to see him as often as we could if we lived in the state of New York, which has been sort of hard for us. And although he has quite a great support group there who see to it that his needs are taken care of and get visiting to get him out of the cell itself, it's been very trying for me. Like I said, it's been 48 years. We've had to deal with this situation. And after a while, you don't really become complacent. Every 2 years, you just keep praying and hoping that they're going to finally let him come home. And that's been one of my greatest fears, that he would expire or I would expire before he's released, that he would expire in prison or I would expire here before he comes home. You learn to deal with it. The first few years, I was very frightened that they were going to kill him. And he managed to keep himself alive, I would say, for all these years. Although there was a time when they were throwing him in what they called the hole every other day, it seemed. Like whatever he did or would not do, they would manufacture reasons to throw him in the hole. And then, of course, we'd have to fight to get him out, and then he'd have to write appeals, and it's just been a trying time, it's the best I can put it. We've had his brother, sister, and family has written, you know, to the board each time, trying to get some empathy to release him. And, of course, they're all aware of his achievements, with the exception of the family member that was part of his incarceration. Don't want to get into the political end of it anymore. Just want to say that he has great expectations for himself when he is released eventually. I'm sure we're hoping that it's going to be this year. He has potential for a job, living quarters, a great support group in New York for him. And that was the reason why he decided to stay there, because of the support. And then, of course, them paroling him to the state. So just sort of resigned to the fact that he's going to be there and try to make the best of it. And I think that that's not a bad thing, because of the support that he's received all these years from the supporters there in the state of New York.
And you'll still be able to visit him, of course.
Yes, yes. As I say, my greatest fear has just been that don't let me expire or before we get a chance to be a family again outside of prison walls. I do go and have what they call family reunion visits with him, where I stay in 2 days. We cook and we you know, just have a good visit together. He's a jazz enthusiast, and so am I. So we listen to music, and we talk about times when he was coming up, and some of the facilities they had, you know, games, and we played basketball and whatever, just to make it as humanized as we possibly could behind the walls of a prison.
Yes. As you mentioned, his co-defendant, Herman Bell, was released. What's the difference between Herman Bell's situation and your son's?
I don't think there is, as far as I know, there is not a difference. It's just that the board members who released Herman, I guess we're hoping that he will get a board that will be as liberal or has as much empathy when he comes up in September again. He was supposed to have been coming out in June of last year, or was it April? And somehow or another, they put a charge in his record, which meant that he had to have the burden of proof put on him to refute these charges. So by the time he got that done, they gave him 6 months to get it cleared up, which he did. And then it was election time. So then he was advised to wait until after the elections. And so now that put him into December, or at least September of this year. So the board more or less gave him another, it's like rather than giving him what they call a hit, which means that you are denied and then you're not eligible to go to the board again for 2 years, they gave him 15 months.
And of course, like all of the Black Panther political prisoners, the police unions vehemently reject ever allowing them out of jail, and they get backing from the local mayor and the governor.
Exactly. It's just that, I guess whoever is familiar with the times of the 60s and 70s, where Hoover and Nixon, you know, conspired to dismantle these movements, and was the Panthers were considered terrorists. They were America's terrorists at that time, and of course. They said, well, everybody was accused of killing police officers. Well, that's who they were fighting with or against, was the brutality of the police officers. So, but he has done a wonderful job since he's been incarcerated. He, as I was telling in one of my letters, I was saying that we had thought maybe we had not done our job appropriately, but he and our endeavors had been sort of stricken, but then he made us feel that all our endeavors were not in vain when he got his degree. He continued his education because he was already in college. He's been college bound since 16. He spent his summers in the Upward Bound program at San Jose State College. And then, of course, when he was arrested, he was working for the state of California, human resources as a counselor, employment counselor, and taking classes at San Francisco City College and State College. So when he got ready to get his bachelor's or his bachelor's degree, they didn't think that he had even graduated high school. So I had to get his papers together and send them so that he could go to college. And you probably know that he has a BS and a BA. From State College, New Paltz in New York.
As a mother, how did you feel when he changed his name from the one you gave him, Anthony Bottoms, to Jahlil Abdul Muntakim?
I felt that if he was comfortable with that, and then we know who he is. I know who he is. And he chose to go Muslim. He was raised Methodist and Catholic, believe it or not. He was baptized in Catholic as a Catholic, and then of course the other side of the family is Methodist, Episcopals or AME, and I think that choice was made due to the support in prison. So it was okay, as I said. I know who he is. He knows who he is. But then for his own comfort and security, he chose to go Muslim, and it was okay. It's all right with the family. I refer to him as Jahlil sometimes, but he will always be Tony to me.
And there's a petition circulating. Could you explain and why people should sign it?
The petition for him to be released on time served is simply because he has no family in the state of New York. And if he's under the supervision of parole, then that limits his movements. He would have to be there under their jurisdiction, cannot leave from that state. And so that's really the purpose. Plus, I think he's served his time. He has proven that he is has been an exemplary prisoner, caught up in the times of youth. And we just feel that he should be granted some relief at this point. And as I said, to allow him to be able to travel, be free enough to go and see, visit his family and friend as he would choose. As a matter of fact, his brother and sisters and I were planning a cruise just to give him some water and some, being from the state of California, you're used to having water around you and just peaceful cruise for 7 days. Just to relax, unwind, and try to reacclimate himself to outside of those walls that he spent. Really and truly, they have had him longer than I did. I had him for 18 years, 19 years, and they've had him for 40-some years. He was raised in the prison system. When you think about it, he was 19 years old, and now he'll be 68 in October.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.